Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Cybersecurity Matters. I'm your host, Dominic Vogel, and joining me, as always, is my better-looking half, Mr. Christian Redshaw.
Wow, Christian. That was unexpected.
Yeah. Christian, who do we have that we're chatting with today?
We actually have Mr. Greg Vandergast, who is a very entertaining cybersecurity leader. He is head of security at the University of Salford in Manchester, England, and I can't wait to have a chat with him.
To say Greg is funny would be a colossal understatement. So we will take a pause here. We'll bring Greg in and we're going to have one heck of a convo.
Greg, welcome to Cybersecurity Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Greg, Chris and I are just so happy to have you on the show. I mean, you and I connected on LinkedIn, close to a year ago, and you're one of my favorite people to follow on LinkedIn. You're such an interesting character. You always make me laugh. I think you're one of the few security leaders in the space that just tells it like it is. So I know Chris and I appreciate that. And the question we'd like to start off with is maybe if you could share a bit about your story. You know, what's brought you to where you are today?
I think it's going to be like a year and a half since we, I remember talking on the phone like two summers ago. So it's been a while. What do you want to know? Just kind of my that's unlikely. At least that's what I tell my lawyers and the prosecutors. you just want my story from the very beginning?
Wherever you see fit.
I started out. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's relevant, even though it only became relevant later. I mean, I started out as just kind of a geeky kid and always very curious, I guess. I was one of those kids that liked taking stuff apart. And I got my first PC when I was about 15. And, you know, now a year later, the feds raided the house because I'd hacked into someone's nuclear weapons program and a few other things. And then, you know, it was made, it's quite interesting actually, because, they put me in the back of a van and brought me someplace and kept me there for several days without ever reading me my rights or charging me with anything. So that was not sure how that's legal. To this day, I don't know where I was. But then they made me, they made me a job offer that, I couldn't refuse. They were really adamant about the couldn't refuse part.
Yeah.
And that was the Defense Department, and then in the States, and then the FBI joined in on that, and I spent the next like 2.5-3 years doing weird covert stuff with a lot of weird people. That I've probably said too much, so I'll spare the details. It will fascinate me. I've woken up to some very strange things, and it wasn't all behind the computer. You know, when you go to a restaurant and then you end up being debriefed at an airfield, and in the airfield is every single person in the restaurant, and they're all like police officers and federal agents, and they're like, why are we meeting at an airport? Oh, because the aerial surveillance will be landing soon. Like, okay, that seems a bit overkill, but that's why the U.S. government spends $740 billion on defense, I guess.
That's right.
To have two planes in the air to monitor you while you have dinner. So yeah, did that. One thing out of that is I did get to see did a lot of intelligence gathering, but also saw a lot of breaches, because you're talking like late 90s. So there was no, you know, NIPC had just been set up. It was like the early days of computer crime and that kind of stuff. And people in the government would find out about us. And so when a breach would happen, when, you know, a government contractor or something would get compromised or a part of the government would get compromised, they'd reach out to us. So I was exposed to like probably a couple hundred breaches plus however many I did before that. and that was kind of my education, right? Because I'm, you know, here I am, a high school dropout. I never went to university. I don't have which is ironic because I now guest lecture at the university. I have no formal background. So I was never kind of what I like to call now indoctrinated.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember first becoming exposed to the security industry and all the frameworks and the standardized stuff. And I was like, it just doesn't make sense to me. This doesn't resolve to what I've been dealing with. Like, it doesn't map. It's all been quite abstract. I don't get how people are using this and to secure themselves effectively. And I thought I was quite stupid for not getting it for the longest time. And it's only about 10 years later I realized, ah, wait, they're not securing themselves effectively, are they? So, yeah, after that, I started doing, you know, some architecture work, a lot of consulting work, making a lot of money, and then made too much money, decided, hey, let me go buy a Lamborghini and visit Italy while I'm at that. And that visit lasted 7 years. Italy is the best place in the world to drive a car, by the way, because people say, oh, Germany, no speed limits. Well, Italy has speed limits everywhere, but they don't care, which is much better. I have many selfies with police officers. Yeah, yeah. How fast were you going? 3 times the limit? Fantastico, grandissimo. Yeah. I ended up working for QVC, setting up their information security program there. Quite a weird period. I got a bit fed up with IT. I got out and eventually went broke. And then 2 years ago, I moved back to the UK to make a living. Worked for the BBC for a while. Worked for a large MSP here called Capita, which is kind of like Canada's CGI. Hmm. Do you have CGI on the West Coast?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is where I worked when I was back in Montreal. And I took over the handling of the security of the you know, everybody knows the BBC, obviously, the TV licensing unit, because here you pay an annual tax for your television TV license. And after 3 months, the BBC said, we don't want Greg reporting to your CISO anymore. We want Greg to report directly to the managing director. He's a strategic account, importance of the account, blah, blah, blah. And the CISO didn't like that very much, so he fired me the next day, or she fired me the next day. And that doesn't surprise anyone in this country that knows Capita, by the way. But that's what that was. And then I had like a very, very long drought, because obviously my approach to security has always been very pragmatic. Like, this is what works for me. I really believe in doing the fundamentals. Because I look at all the big breaches, you know, look at TravelX and Capital One and Marriott and Equifax and British Airways. You know, it's always asset management, patching, configuration standards, code review, configuration, you know, stuff like basic stuff. Yeah. And no one's doing it. And what bothers that, security people will whinge about it, but not actually do anything about it. And they'll go spend, you know, like 5,000 man months of effort setting up a SOC to catch the stuff that could have been prevented had they spent a week talking to some guy and convincing him, hey, could we just do it this way? Just because it's outside of that, you know, we've established a standardized, this is what security is. This is best practice. This is blah, blah, blah. And I've never subscribed to any of that. And I believe in just massive fanatical engagement of the business. And a lot of people criticize what I say, like, oh, you can't because, you know, you can never stop everything. Okay, you can't, but you can do a hell of a lot better. And I'm talking orders of magnitude better than what we're doing today. Because, you know, none of these places are getting breached by, you know, like, oh, sophisticated nation-state attacker.
Nation-state actors.
Yeah, yeah. $20 says it was SQL injection, you know?
Yeah.
by some kid in a basement somewhere. You know? And it's always, you know... And one of the five I just named, you know, I was talking to some of the investigators, and they discovered a switch at one point. And they asked them, like, what's connected to this switch? And the security team didn't know. And you're thinking, what am I going to say? Was it a rogue Wi-Fi access point? What is a Raspberry Pi? No, it was an entire company they acquired 6 years before that they hooked up to the network there. And no one, you know, the security team wasn't even aware of that, you know? So, of course, you've got no asset management. You've got no, your patching processes, your EDR, none of that stuff is in place there. So you can, you know, you can have the fanciest security tooling, next-gen AI, blockchain, whatever you want.
Yeah.
But if you don't even know what machines are there because you haven't bothered having a cup of coffee with people to discover what's going on in your actual business, it makes no sense. It doesn't work. It can never work without that foundation. And most of the breaches we're seeing they're not that complex. I mean, yeah, they're a sequence of events, but each individual one tends to be relatively low complexity. Okay, don't expect someone on the street to understand a buffer overflow, but, you know, to the average 15-year-old computer savvy kid, it's, you know, a piece of code you can download on the internet in 5 minutes is not that complicated. It's about being aware of things holistically and maintaining them holistically and consistently. That's what, to me, it's really about. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have just completely given up on that in favor of, no, you can't prevent, you have to do detection and respond. No? All right. Well, you could. You just haven't tried hard enough. I mean, if you tried one-tenth as hard as you're trying to do all this detection and response stuff, you probably would have prevented all these things. You know, mm-hmm. There's no reason why you would have a host that you're not aware of. You know, if you have, you know, it has an IP address, it's on your network, you know, a Tanium or a BigFix or an Ivanti or something like that would have picked it up just because it's sending ARP requests on the network. And if you had one of the box on the segment, you would have picked it up. So there's a lot of excuses, you know, and we blame users a lot too, you know, like the weakest link in the chain. Well, the first link in the chain, and granted, it's more difficult to protect that because you can't anticipate human behavior and that kind of stuff. But very often it's okay. The attacker compromised that user's machine because he clicked on a link or gave his credentials or whatever. But that's the first step in the kill chain. And then, you know, the fact that you got completely owned in ransomware 6 months later is because, well, you know, well, you went from there and you got through your gateway, which, you know, you hadn't configured properly, and then got on your routers because that had default passwords, and you didn't upgrade the firmware on your firewalls, and then you hadn't patched anything in your data center, and then they set up all kinds of tunneling, and in 6 months time, you didn't detect a single thing. But, you know, let's blame Dave from marketing. Because it's all his fault. You know? You know,
Greg,
like,
I think this could be the first episode where we only actually ask one question and then you just give us all the answers without us having to do any of the work. It's awesome. You're making our job easy today.
No. We could listen to you all day. That was honestly the most interesting, because we normally start every episode with that question. I can say bar none, that was the most interesting background story of any guest. So I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, you get the gold
medal.
Your lives
must be terribly boring.
Yes, they are. Especially during COVID.
I think they are. Now that we listen to your life story, I think they are. So I have a couple of cybersecurity questions for you, Greg, and feel free to answer them in your own unique way and style. The first one is, from your perspective, why does cybersecurity matter?
Yeah, you know, it's like any kind of security. Why does that matter? Because I don't like having people run to my house at 3 a.m. grabbing my TV all the time. You know, seems fairly obvious. I'm quite curious what other people answer to that question. It matters. I mean, it matters for obvious reasons, right? It's really, really obvious why it matters. Security matters. No one likes to feel unsafe. No one likes to have even the hassle of having, you know, even if it doesn't impact you directly, you know, your credit card's compromised or like in North America, it's quite bad with identity theft because you don't have personal ID cards and that kind of system where, you know, it's you are basically what they can piece together from you. So it's very easy to take over someone's identity. That's obviously a big hassle. It can get you in trouble. I'm quite worried about like some emerging technologies like blockchain. Now, blockchain is quite weird because it's a technology that doesn't actually do anything. It's like having well, by itself, you know, there are many applications where you could use blockchain, but blockchain itself is just a component. So it's weird that they have their own fanatical lobbying group and everything and government interest groups and all this stuff. It's like, you know, there's no wheel lobby. No one's lobbying for circles. There's loads of stuff you could do with that. You know, you lobby for the end product. You know, there's a car lobby that uses circles because the wheels are circular. But blockchain is kind of run away with this own thing. But it creates things like, and I'm focusing on blockchain, but this is something I've been wanting to say for a while, actually. It creates things like, everyone says that blockchain is absolutely secure, right?
Right.
And it could be relatively secure, but you're creating this sense of certainty about it.
Yeah.
And so when blockchain starts being used to manage people's identities and criminal records, and someone compromises, maybe not blockchain itself, but one of the underlying hosts, and therefore is able to corrupt the information within the blockchain, someone's going to get a piece of information at some point that is absurd. You know, like, I've done unspeakable things while I was in a different country, while I was actually still here, and you get 100 witnesses, but they will believe the blockchain because they believe in its integrity. And this is a real big problem I have. And I see even with security practitioners, there's a lack of holistic critical thinking.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And when we start creating trust in technology at that level, it becomes very, very dangerous also from a kind of social perspective. So I think that's one of the reasons why security is becoming increasingly important in a very, because it can become something very insidious. Our trust in technology can be a very, very dangerous thing when we start trusting it too blindly. And unfortunately, human nature is we do trust it blindly. And even security practitioners all the time, I'm like, you guys are working with your blinders on. I mean, I've done a few assessments for law firms where they want me to go into an organization and show that they've been negligent because there was a conflict between the law firm's clients and stuff. It's never taken me more than 3 hours to show like significant negligence. Like you have really, really bad things that anyone would understand. Like that there's a monumental failure in governance and security here. And this is despite, you know, KPMG and BSI and other big fours like rubber stamping everything for years.
Yep.
We know audits costing hundreds of thousands of dollars and pounds. And how did you miss this? Because there's just no holistic thinking. They just go, well, controls, tick boxes, checklists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's just kind of following the standards and not actually looking at how does this business operate and what random outside factors could have, you know, how could things work together in this particular situation? And I think I'm going on quite a tangent now, but that's what worries me about. So, I mean, security is becoming, because we're starting to live on like abstraction layers of technology. We all have so much technology in our lives that we don't even understand how it works. So it being secure is incredibly important. And people don't realize that. But even the security practitioners, I find by large are still missing the kind of security mentality, what I would call like the hacker mentality of just wanting to understand how everything works and seeing different scenarios, you know, that how can I make this work in an unexpected way or how might this be affected in an unexpected way?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not seeing that. And I'm really worried about the standardization of roles and practices and that kind of stuff. We're trying to standardize and mature the security industry by doing that, but we're actually taking the thinking out of it. And I believe that security it's not a knowledge game, it's a thinking game. And if you gained a piece of knowledge without thinking about it, it's probably not right for your particular situation.
Mm-hmm. So when talking about taking a pragmatic approach, most of the people that watch this show are small and mid-sized business owners or business leaders. How would you suggest in just really practical steps, somebody in that demographic would get started with reasonable, legally defensible cybersecurity?
Yeah, I think the small businesses are always gonna struggle because it's such a wide area that you realistically need either several people or very, very senior expensive people to kind of delegate or figure that work. And that's the problem because they can't do that. They can't afford it. The good news is that no matter what certain vendors might be telling us, you don't need AI powered this and that to be more secure. No one knows who I'm talking about, thank God. They're a victim of their own marketing success. Okay, let's put it that way. The fundamentals is what's going to get most people compromised. And the good thing about small businesses is that they don't have that much complexity. And most of them, they know all their staff. You've got 10 employees, it's fairly easy to manage things. But really basic stuff, you know, change your Wi-Fi access point password. Now, hire a consultant for a couple of days. Hire, like, if you can, hire a guy who's like $500, $600, $700. I don't know what the contract rates are. But pay the money for a few days and spend a couple grand. Just go through all your network settings. You know, if you have a small domain controller, how that's set up. Your firewall settings, your access point, your accounts, you know, sit through, you know, a couple of hours of training that will make a world of difference to small businesses. I think that will eliminate like 95% of your exposure for
but
very
Greg,
very
isn't
small
isn't IT already handling all that? Don't they have that covered already?
Are you
facetious?
He's being, yeah.
I'm not going to mention my current IT department.
Okay.
I'm not. let's just say I've been in organizations where the number one information security risk in the risk register is our own IT department. Right. So, you do have to be aware of IT practices. And you know, I was thinking of like fairly small where you wouldn't necessarily have an IT department or you'd have maybe one IT guy.
Right.
They're not necessarily going to be security savvy. Bring in some outside knowledge, because I think at that scale you can actually make it very interesting if you get the right person in to do it. Because people are generally, if you present it in a way that's not incredibly boring, people are actually a lot more interested in security than you think they would be. Right. If you just speak plain English and stop going off on industry gobbledygook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all right. You have an awesome book called Rethinking InfoSec. And by the way, I'm still waiting on my autographed version of that. But one of the things which I...
I'll print out a whole bunch to bring to conferences, COVID. Yeah.
You still have the stack, right, after COVID. Yeah. And one of the things, the concepts, and you've been hinting at this already, again, is about trying to rethink how InfoSec is currently done, you know, and the organization, the industry is just stuck in a groupthink mentality. And, you know, I think you had a great word there about blind trust. You know, there's blind trust on technology, there's blind trust on using frameworks, and people aren't thinking critically. I know one of the themes which you talked about, and again, you mentioned it earlier there, was rather than dealing with the symptoms, look upstream. You know, the solutions to our technology, you know, quote unquote, InfoSec problems don't have to be solved with technology. It can often be solved with a conversation, and for at least maybe
the technology, but further upstream, you know, affect the architecture rather than trying to build 1,000 controls over
exactly architecture. Exactly. And you know, for those again, both technology people and security people, mainly for them, how important is it that they really start focusing on better communication skills? Like I said, I know you've already hinted at it, but how important is it that they get away from their desk, wherever they are in the building, and actually go out and talk? Again, I know it's difficult during COVID, but how important is it they actually focus on having conversations rather than implementing technology?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, the implementing the technology is going to be there, but if you don't have the technology, if you don't have the conversation, you're probably not going to implement the right technology, or at least not in the right way, or have the right coverage. I'm working at a university. It's extremely broad. We have hundreds of departments. There's, you know, all kinds of research and in-house consultancies and industry collaboration things. And we do all kinds of crazy stuff. And, you know, they're all academics. So it's all a bit weird. Weird's a good word. But every time one of these people, you know, contacts me, like, hey, I need so-and-so. And I'm like, you know, or they need a certain thing. And I was like, why do you need this thing? And I'm not going to go there and say no, because that's ridiculous. I'm going to go, when can you have a cup of coffee? Because I want to understand what it is you do. Yeah. And almost every single time when they're asking me for something that I think is, that's not an acceptable security, that represents an unacceptable security risk to do that. There's almost always an underlying reason that I didn't know about, that they didn't think of telling me about, why they're asking that. They're asking that because they have to work around something, because something else hasn't been implemented properly. So I was like, look, I'm not going to give you this, but I'm going to for you so that you get your IT infrastructure that you need implemented properly. That way you don't need these workarounds. So they're like, oh, fantastic. That means we can work better. And it means I don't have to worry about the security implications of having, you know, something poorly provisioned that I then have, and then they have to create workarounds about. And I find there's, you know, we're security. We're usually the ones, you know, in the basement that no one wants to talk to. And we've gotten the feedback of, like, out of the entire IT department of 120 people, the security team is the most communicative ones, the ones that people enjoy working with the most. And we're often the only ones in the broader university in IT that people have spoken to, because we're the only ones that actually go out and talk to everyone to figure out what's actually going on. Because I want to know. And I'm like, you know, I go to procurement and I go to the deans. I'm like, you guys realize you have issues with provisioning here. And you realize that this group is actually trying to do this work, but what you've given them, that doesn't give them that flexibility. And we're doing a ton of business discovery. Like, a third of my team is set up just to do business discovery, just to find out what's going on. And that's hugely important to go talk to people to find out what's actually going on. Because if you don't understand your own business, how are you going to build security around it? And the flip side to that, which is a huge benefit, is you are discovering all kinds of synergies for the business, not even from a security standpoint, but you're helping the business realize, hey, we've got waste here, we've got synergies, we've got things we could do. And you're also discovering the business yourself, which then means if you then go out and you talk to an executive, or you talk to your financial director, your CFO, your CEO, and you know all these people and you know what they're doing, they're going to be impressed by that. You know, you're not just some IT techie, like, you know, here's a guy who's actively involved in all aspects of the business. I'm going to give him more of my time. And that really helps in influencing when you do finally get to that point where, hey, I need some security resource. Hey, I need you guys in the organization, in this department, to change the way you work, because it's a nightmare for me security-wise, and it's costing me a ton of effort, and it's not good for the business, because if you guys can change this at a cost of 20 grand, that means I don't have to spend 100 grand in securing it.
Yeah.
That makes business sense. And they're not necessarily going to want to do it, but when the higher-ups, their bosses, realize, you know what, he's got the business's best interests in mind, and he sees the big picture, that helps you get that traction.
Very good.
It's really, it's helpful for, you know, to do your job. It's helpful to help the business. It's helpful to get you the influence to achieve the things you need, you know, in terms of changing things and not just doing security.
Yeah. Understanding the business and that level of communication with leadership and throughout the organization is so important when it comes to security. Yeah. And I think we're going to end on that note because we're out of time for today, but so awesome to have you. I think definitely, I'd love to keep the cameras rolling and do an episode right away, but we do have to wrap it up. So
you'll be back in season two.
You will be back.
So we'll say hi to you. We'll do it entirely in Italian next time. We'll
have to that sounds good. Teach you Italian. All right, Greg.
You said Italiano? All right.
Arrivederci.
Thanks, Greg. Have a good one. Thanks again.
Alla prossima. Ciao.
Ciao. And Dominic and I will be back to wrap things up in just a moment.
I'm struggling to find the words to describe Greg Vandergast. Wow, epic, unreal. He's just a bag of surprises. What an incredible, incredible conversation. Plus, he's funny as heck.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think nobody's safe around Greg. He's a hilarious guy and also a really smart guy too. Not afraid to say what he thinks. Mm-hmm. Total authenticity and total real pragmatic advice for our business audience.
It was just a terrific conversation. I think it was a fantastic way to wrap up season one of Cybersecurity Matters. You know, it's we've had some fantastic guests this year. It's been amazing that we've had so many guests over the course of a year doing this once a week. The incredible engagement we've had, the incredible support. What are some highlights from you?
Yeah,
from this past year?
For me, I think of Von Hazen, the CN Chief Information Security Officer. Yeah. I think of guests like Mark Metry. Yeah. Heather Monahan, we've just had such a great variety, cybersecurity and otherwise.
We're just so thankful to all our viewers and listeners for sticking with us through this full year. We're very excited about season two, which will be coming out sometime in September. Please do stay tuned for that. But as always, we appreciate your love and support and consistent engagement on our social media platforms with Cybersecurity Matters. We very much look forward to bringing season two, like I said, to you sometime in the early fall. But please do make sure that you check out the Conversations That Matter YouTube page for previous episodes and the other podcasts under the umbrella. But until next time, stay on the flip side, and we'll catch you sometime in the fall.
We'll see you in season two.